the best product.
I've been involved in the Patagonia field testing program for a little over 20 years right now.
For silent sports done in nature.
That's the feeling. That's the feeling that I fell in love with climbing.
Cause no unnecessary harm.
Of organic cotton and recycle polyester, to recycling the clothing, to measuring our carbon footprint.
Inspire and implement solutions to the environmental crisis.
To give some love back to this river that doesn't have any. It's not getting any love.
See what drives us at Patagonia.com. With additional support from Kuat Rax and New Belgium Brewing.
Love. It's life's great surprise. But beyond that, I know nothing about it. Seriously. I've learned that there is no point in trying to understand it, why it'll work for one couple, and then the seemingly perfect duo, they split apart. It's so beyond me that I stopped trying to guess or understand it. You could chase the science, you could check out the brain chemistry, the serotonin, the melatonin levels, the dopamine, etc., etc., but it wouldn't provide any perspective why a muscle-bound jock will lock himself in his bedroom and spend a weekend making a mixtape of romantic songs from the 1980s, or why a chronically timid person will stand up in a crowded room filled with people and walk across it and introduce themselves to the person of their dreams. This stuff is a mystery. From my experience, it is the most powerful emotion, more powerful than even survival instinct. It can be simultaneously obsessively drawing us in and making us terrified of it. It's a wonderful catharsis. But in my opinion, if you're lucky enough, it can evolve into a deep, quiet stillness of an aspen stand where one tree morphs into the next. Finding it, that's another story. Good luck drawing a roadmap to true love. It might be ready to bite you in the ass, or there's a good chance that you're going to have to sail across the ocean to find it. I do, however, know what makes a great love story. It's a basic equation followed by every romantic comedy Hollywood has ever made. It starts with a brief encounter that sparks an initial interest. This is followed by an awkward, if not comical, attempt to reconnect. The two lovers meet, they fall in love, their relationship grows, and then something goes wrong. There's a period of disconnect where it looks bad for our heroes. And then, in the end, serendipity strikes. And if it's a Dirtbag Diaries love story, they'll use the same formula, but there's also a good chance that it's going to involve a voodoo doctor. Hey, you do what it takes for love, right? Today, we present Be Mine, two stories about finding love. We've wanted to do a Valentine's Day story for years now, but we wanted to find the right stories. And I think we've got them. I'm Fitz Cahal, and you're listening to The Dirtbag Diaries.
I only live for your love and
Anne and Jonah met, like any good dirtbag would hope to, on a ski lift at Snowbowl Resort just outside of Missoula, Montana.
You know, riding up that lift together, and I started asking Anne questions about, what do you like to do? And, you know, she said she was clearly a tele skier, and she liked to rock climb. And, you know, the more we talked, the more that I just realized right away that, it's like, wow, this woman is incredible. You know, she's passionate about all the same things that I believe are beautiful in the world. I was just sort of smitten right from the beginning, you know, and I was like, this is what I want. This is what I'm after. And, you know, from the first chairlift, even though there wasn't a lot of practical, I did anything I could do after that to try to be close to her. We would go ski together every now and again. We didn't see each other that much, but I lived in a little cabin way up in the Indian reservation, and we didn't have electricity. We didn't have any running water. It was super rustic. So eventually I get her to come up. And what does she do? She passes out, you know. And there I am, so super excited to get this girl I love up to the woods and everything. And she sleeps.
And
for
it
like
didn't just happen
days.
Once. It happened at least two or three times. I would just, by the end of the weekend, I was just so relaxed. I thought of him as a friend. I didn't want anything else, though. And I think that's where things started to change. Because we had this period together up at his cabin, and where I thought he was my shama. But as our relationship progressed through the following years, I kind of felt that he really liked me. And he started driving me crazy. And I'd probably have attention span of him for, you know, we could spend maybe a week together on a trip. But beyond that, I didn't want to be around.
So I was the one who was sort of pursuing Anne, and she did not see our relationship at all, like, in that light, you know. And I was the sort of guy who was kind of used to that, you know. I always struggled dating, you know. I never met anyone like Anne before. And so this one, you know, meant more, and I was going to put more into it.
Anne moved to L.A. for grad school. Jonah stayed in Missoula. But they kept in touch. When Jonah traveled to Nepal, he'd make sure that he'd go through L.A. so that they could take a 10-day trip into the Sierra. Then they'd say goodbye. They'd move on to the task at hand, the path of traveling, of learning, following dreams in a self-propelled and singular fashion. It was in that age when adulthood and the settledness that growing older brings, it seemed distant, like way out on the horizon. Months would pass without contact, without knowing where the other one was calling home for that moment, or what they were up to. As Anne finished grad school, she was accepted to the Peace Corps. With just a few months remaining until she left, she knew she had to buckle down to get her thesis done. So she went to Michigan to work in her family's small cottage.
And it was only me there at the time. And Jonah had been calling me.
So, and this is an important one because this is our little shamanic story, right?
When I got in touch with him, he had been driving from South Carolina back to Missoula, and he was 10 miles down the road, not knowing where I was, not even knowing that I was in Michigan. And so he came over, and he spent a couple days, and it was great having him there, but I still had that really, that deep down feeling where I knew that he liked me, so he would drive me crazy and all. All I wanted to do was just work on my thesis project.
That was an amazing one where, because again, like we didn't, in those 10 years, like we didn't get to see each other that much. And one, you know, for a encounter to be that serendipitous was pretty special.
And then I go to the Peace Corps.
I end up living on a sailboat for maybe 5 years, and Anne went to Peace Corps, and so she was in the middle of the Pacific in an island called Kiribati, and I tried really hard to sail to Kiribati, but, you know, sailing is very seasonal, and you have to avoid typhoons and all these sorts of things, so I ended up not being able to sail to Kiribati, but I sailed to New Zealand, and when she was leaving Kiribati, she went through Fiji, and I sailed from New Zealand up to Fiji. And so we met again there.
The last couple months were really, really difficult. And I'm telling him about everything that's been going on for the last 2 years and the last couple months. And I just, you know, kind of released everything to him. And we decided to sail out to a little island out in this bay. And one night we're, you know, sitting on the deck watching the sunset. And he's telling me how he's in love with me, and that one day we're gonna have a little place together and have a little farm and a little house. And I'm just looking at him, shaking my head, being like, what are we doing here? All I wanna do is get off this boat. The next day I made him take me to shore, and I bought a plane ticket to go home, and I left. And I was done with our friendship.
I do admit that even for me, this was like a low point as a compassionate person, right? Because, you know, I spent all my life trying to be a loving person and supporting people that I loved, you know? And so I was in a low point in my own life. It was just, you know, I lived alone on a boat, and, you know, that has its highs and its lows. And, you know, I was probably lonely, and here I was seeing someone I loved, but I didn't have a lot of strength that particular moment in life where I should have been fully supportive of Anne and the fact that she was going through a hard time. And I was trying to do that, but I couldn't, you know, keep my own energies and my own passions like inside as I should have. And I knew, you know, I even knew then, but, you know, I kept talking myself, oh, this is the right way to talk about it. It was really painful to leave, you know, on bad terms without being able to talk it through. You know, we apologized for for being stressed out and unhappy. But this was one of the, you know, probably the hardest thing that we've been through as a couple, as far as, you know, we were just both in bad places in life, and we weren't really supporting each other. We didn't have the firm ground where we could actually give each other what we needed. We both needed totally different things. And I kept sailing.
A year later, Jonah landed in South Carolina for a wedding. Then he flew to Seattle to meet Anne. They patched things up. They were both in better places.
One of the more valuable things that came out of that, other than us just, you know, sort of getting past some of the difficulties we had had in the Pacific, Anne had a roommate named Mike Kim, and we really hit it off. He really went to bat for me, you know, and you know, she was dating guys or whatever. And he's like, why don't you spend more time with Jonah?
I would just kind of not really listen to him. Jonah went back to go sailing again. And so he would always ask me, like, where's Jonah now? Where's Jonah? And I would tell him where he was or if I had heard from him. But he just continuously throughout the next 3 years would always ask me about him.
But Anne was not convinced. So Jonah left again for his sailboat, and Anne continued living in Seattle. He sailed to the Philippines, Japan, Indo-Tanzania, Cape Town, and then a tiny island called St. Helena, 1,100 miles off the west coast of Angola. From there, he sailed 55 days back to South Carolina.
And so it's a really long passage from Africa to South Carolina. And I was sort of taking an assessment of my life, and I'd been sailing for 5 or 6 years. And, you know, you can kind of choose to either accept that as a lifestyle, because it's a pretty peaceful life. If you can make just enough money to get by, then you can, you know, it's easy to maintain a really small boat. And, you know, I really considered maybe like, look, I could do this forever and I could, you know, live alone and, you know, sail around and just sort of eke out and squeak out a living. But it didn't feel right. And it's like, I missed climbing and skiing in cold weather, you know? And I was like, you know, I think I want to make this happen. I really believe in making this work with Anne. And, you know, everything we've talked about shows how Anne wasn't invested in it at all, right? But it didn't dissuade my heart, right? I was always after it. And so I sailed into Charleston, you know, I put my boat for sale, and I took my brother's truck, and I was like, Charles, I'm driving to Seattle. I got to go marry Anne, right? And so I had talked to Anne already. It's like, hey, we should go on a climbing trip. You know, for me, it was just like, clearly defined thing. I mean, get there and we're going to do this. And Anne's like, well, we can, I guess, do something. Like, you know, clearly not that big of a deal, you know. But I'm determined. I'm driving across the country. And this is really ironic because I happen to drive through Missoula. And my truck breaks down. Or I should say my brother's truck, right? I drove all the way from South Carolina to Missoula and the bloody truck breaks down within a mile of where I used to live. Meanwhile, I'm supposed to meet Anne in Seattle like the next day. I'm going to have to hitchhike. This is important. I want to get to Washington. And coincidentally, I had some friends from Port Townsend who were in Montana, and they were driving back. So I called them to see if they were leaving the next day. And they were like, yes, but we're not actually going back to Port Townsend or Seattle. We're going up to OMAC for the OMAC Stampede. I'm like, well, that's close enough. That's, you know, as good as I'm going to get. So pick me up on your way through. You know, I call Ann. I'm like, well, I can't make it to Seattle, but I can make it to OMAC. So you gotta, you know, if you'll get the food and this and make a plan and do everything, right, I'll just, you know, you can pick me up in OMAC.
Meanwhile.
At the time, I went down to Rainier with some friends, telling them, you know, I'm going on this trip with this guy. We don't really have plans, but he's either going to drive me crazy or I'm going to fall madly in love with him, knowing that that's not going to happen.
But Anne goes. She organizes everything for a trip and picks up Jonah and OMAC. They decide to backpack in the Satan wilderness, each with their own mindset.
All I keep telling myself is, Anne, don't let anything happen. You do not want anything with this guy. You want to just have a good time. He is your friend. You don't want to push those boundaries.
And Jonah had gotten advice from a girl on the car trip from Missoula.
You just have to let it happen, actually. Let it all lie.
During that 10-day trip, something shifted. When Jonah stopped talking about their relationship, Anne was able to see for herself what they shared. books, the shared quietness of being out together. She felt relaxed around him. They talked a lot about the past, about them, and put aside hurdles that she'd placed around the idea of being in a relationship with Jonah. And she started to see Jonah for Jonah.
I kind of started coming around to the idea that I could like him. And he knew how he felt about me.
Jonah decided to try Seattle for a while, so Anne invited him into her community, to a triathlon, at a friend's wedding. And though he didn't know a soul, he was at ease, talking with her friends. He made them laugh. In their meetups over the 10 years, it was usually just the two of them. And for the first time, Anne was seeing Jonah through other people's eyes, and she liked what she saw.
All of a sudden, it went from the theoretical to reality, sharing friends and things that we had never been able to do before. You know, we would run together, we'd do all of our outdoor things together, which is exactly what drew us together in the first place. And motivating each other to do these things together, it's like, well, that's what really makes me feel alive. And that's what I knew I needed in life. And it was seamless. Like, all of a sudden, it was like we had been doing this for the last 10 years.
But in reality, it had only been 3 weeks, an intense start or restart or whatever you might call a building romantic relationship between two people who knew each other so intimately on some levels. So Anne took a night at home to step back from the relationship, to check in with herself, and hang with Mike.
Mike was like a brother to me, and he saw me with every relationship, and he knew how things were. So Mike sits down, and he says to me, "Do you know why Jonah is really good for you?" And I'm just thinking, oh, Mike, you know this answer. Like, just tell me. And he says, "Jonah is really good to you. And you need someone who is good to you." And it just made me really warm. And I knew at that moment that this was it.
And so after being together for 1 month, and we were camped out by the river, and it was my birthday, and we had a little fire. And before you know it, we were sitting there, and we found ourselves engaged. Like, you know, we just sort of got wrapped up in the moment and thinking about the long, and it's like, I love, this is all I want in life. You know, we got together in August, we got engaged in September, and we got married in the backyard. We had, Anne's mom was a technical witness, and got married by our landlord with Fitz as our only spectator, with the chickens. I would give up an incredible amount of things that I consider valuable in my life to spend my life with Anne. You know, I wake up every day and I'm just insanely grateful to be loved.
Part 2, Voodoo. It started with an application to the Peace Corps. In September 2002, Neil Armstrong was going to Benin, a small country in Western Africa. Before heading there, Neil flew to Philadelphia for the week-long training that all Peace Corps volunteers go through. He mingled with other newly minted volunteers. That first night at dinner, Neil met Laura. She was the free spirit, the hippie-type girl. He was the clean-cut fraternity guy. Obviously, opposites.
I remember sitting across from her at this table and being like, wow, is this someone that I'm going to meet, and is this someone that I could marry? And this cracks me up because I remember this thinking specifically about Laura.
But as the night progressed, Neil talked with others and forgot about Laura until she ended up in the same training group in Africa.
She quickly became one of my best friends. We would drink beers together, tell jokes together, and she quickly became the person that I was hanging out the most with. Our friendship grew, but it really couldn't grow that far, mainly because after 2 months of being in the training village, we were going to be separated. So friendship never really grew into romance.
¶¶ Neil and the other volunteers attended training sessions for their jobs, but also for language, French, and the cultural aspects of Beninese.
One of the training sessions one day was about voodoo. And the voodoo culture originated in the southern area of Togo and Benin. And during the slave trade times, those folks were then taken and put into slavery in places like the West Indies and Brazil. It has a real cultural relevance in Benin. And pretty much everyone there, they are either Christian or they're Muslim. And as they say, they're Muslim during the day and voodoo at night. And so you would see everyone be practicing some of these aspects of voodoo or animism as part of their life. And so in this training session, there was a voodoo priest there who starts talking about the voodoo culture as a whole. And he said, one of the things I want to do is I'm going to show you how we take evil spirits out of pregnant ladies. If the woman is having difficulty, what they will do is they will draw the evil spirit out and into a chicken. And so what I'm going to do is I am going to show you how this works, and then the chicken will die and the evil spirit will go away. So, of course, we didn't believe any of this at all. And as we're sitting there, he takes this live chicken, and it had been running around the ground for a little bit. It was perfectly alert and alive, just like a chicken. So the priest first whispers into the chicken's ear and then presses it to the volunteer's belly, whispers to it again, passes it around the volunteer's body two or three times, whispers again, presses it to the belly, passes it two or three times the other way around the body, and then just sets it down. And he said, we have drawn the evil spirits out of the volunteer, and the chicken will now die. And so he continues on with some of his stories. And we, you know, at least I stopped kind of listening to him and started watching this chicken. And over the next 15 minutes, it was walking around, and then it just kind of sits down. Then you start seeing it panting a little bit, then it lays down. And then after 15 minutes, all of a sudden, in just these wild, jerky motions, it just kind of flies up off the ground and then falls dead. You know, I have a very empirical mind, and I wanted to catch him doing something, but all he did was talk to the chicken and then killed it.
After 2 months of training, they received their assignments. Both Neil and Laura had asked for similar qualities from their experience. No running water, no electricity, far from main roads. Neil ended up in a cotton-producing area in northern Benin. It was sub-Saharan, so it was dry, with lots and lots of dust. Laura was 2 days away, distant by miles and miles of dirt roads on the eastern side of the country.
We knew that we were going to keep in touch, but we didn't really know how. You can go to a post office, but it takes forever. The better way to do it is that you go to a taxi driver and give them 25 cents, and magically somehow the letter gets passed off from taxi driver to taxi driver until it gets back to the, you know, to the person you're sending the mail to. And so we would write each other long letters, just telling about our experience. And our friendship was growing, but we really couldn't act on anything. And so she was always my girlfriend on the other side of the country, the ultimate long-distance relationship where I couldn't talk to her for a month or more.
And that distance made Neil a little doubtful. Communication was delayed by days, even weeks, so it was hard to know exactly if Laura's feelings were growing stronger. But they kept writing and kept meeting up on their breaks. Neil wasn't the only one trying to navigate the pitfalls of love. He'd been listening to his friend Sabi lament about the girl he was chasing, how she kept turning Sabi down again and again. He was a teacher, he didn't have a lot of money, and he needed some way to show her that he was worthy of her love.
One day I was sitting in my house and he rolls up on his motorcycle and he's like, Neil, you're coming with me. Where are we going? He's like, I'm finally going to get her. And so I didn't really know what this meant. So I hop on his motorcycle, we start going down a bigger road, then a smaller road, then we start getting onto small little paths going through forest, and we're going past cotton farms and corn farms.
After an hour, they arrived at a farm. The man they were looking for was still in the fields, so they waited in the small mud brick house.
And finally, this old man, he must have been 60, 70 years old, strong as an ox, he comes in and they start talking.
Neil couldn't understand the local language, so he just sat back and watched.
And my friend gives him 100 francs, which is about 25 cents. And suddenly the guy wipes off the dirt floor and starts making chicken scratches with two of his fingers. So he's making little hash marks, wiping them out, hash marks, asking a few more questions, hash marks, rubbing them out. And then my friend says, okay. And he's like, okay, Neil, let's get up and go. And I said, whoa, what just happened there? Well, what did he say? He's like, well, in order to get this girl to marry me, I'm going to have to make a sacrifice. I need to go back to the village. I need to buy the purest white chicken I can find, tie up its feet, take it into the shower. And the showers we took were bucket showers, and so you'd get a large pail of well water and then a bucket, and you can shower with that. And then I have to wash my entire body with this live chicken. And once I have fully washed myself with this chicken, I'm to let it go. And then she will marry me. And so I'm like, this is fascinating. So I said, can I do it? I have this girl that I want to marry me, and I don't know where this is going. So I pay him 100 francs, and the guy starts making his hash marks. He's rubbing them out, hash marks. He says, okay, this is what you're going to do. You're going to make a sacrifice as well. What I need to do is I'm going to buy a kilo of sugar, and over the course of the day, I have to sacrifice the sugar by giving it to anyone I see. And so I went back to my village, and I bought a kilo of sugar, and then as I walked around, I saw people, I greeted them, and I said, would you like sugar? And they looked at me strangely, and I handed them a handful of sugar, and in a couple hours, I had sacrificed or given away all my sugar. Even as I'm telling this story about voodoo and about sacrifice, people have more of like the movie version in their mind about what sacrifice is and what voodoo is. When we hear about it, we think about the killing, about the blood. You're gonna kill a goat, and that's a sacrifice. But really, in that culture, what the sacrifice is that things such as chicken and goats and sugar, these are money to them. They don't have enough money to often buy chickens, yet that's what the sacrifice is that you have to buy it, use it for this reason, and then you have to let it go for love or for health, whatever that is, and you can't have it anymore. It's not about violence or blood or, you know, any kind of dark magic. It's just simply that you need to give up something in order to receive something.
So did Sabi's sacrifice work?
He was after her for months, and she said no. And all the reasons that she said no hadn't changed. But all of a sudden, maybe it was persistence, and maybe it was him washing himself with a pure white chicken. But in a couple months, she had said yes, and they got married.
And Niels? Well, Niels says it's already seemed promising.
At that point, when I talked to the old man was when I decided that I wanted to marry her, but I actually didn't tell her until I got married. At that point, that internally was my commitment to wanting to marry her.
After he and Laura were done with Peace Corps, they moved back to the States together. But he didn't tell Laura what he'd done, not until 4 years later.
I didn't want to jinx it. I didn't want to tell her. I didn't want to tell family, but then It might have been the wedding week that I finally decided to tell everyone, and she was as shocked as the rest of them. Maybe it was voodoo and magic for me as well, but yeah, we're married and we have a beautiful 2-year-old.
Many thanks to Anne, Jonah, and Neil for sharing their stories of love. I will never forget Anne and Jonah's wedding. It was such a wonderful knock to receive on my door, inviting me over to watch a wedding. So cool. Music today by the immortal Tony Bennett, former Utopia Bradley Carter, New Buffalo, Angelique Kijo, and Sean Hayes. You can download the tracks for free at our website, dirtbagdiaries.com. The Diaries would not be possible without support from the good people at Patagonia. Their Common Waters campaign is about balancing human water use with the rest of the planet. They've turned an eye on their business practices and are committed to reducing water pollution from textiles. Learn more at patagonia.com. Support for the show comes from Kuat Racks, makers of a better bike rack. Their design team bikes a lot to give you clean lines and well-designed products. You can see their full lineup at kuatracks.com. I'm Fitz Cahal, and you've been listening to the Dirtbag Diaries. Happy Valentine's Day. Every bird, there's a bird. Now go on, go on. Come on, come on, go on. That's fun. You're just falling.